Hi, I'm Spencer.
And I'm Blake.
And you're about to get jumped.
Welcome to episode 226 of Blake and Spencer Get Jumped, a weekly podcast where we watch the anime so you don't have to.
But you should still totally watch the anime.
This week on Get Jumped, we're watching Naruto Shippuden episodes 205 through 208, plus the fifth episode of Star Wars Visions Season 2, wherein one, the solution to a war isn't necessarily what you think, and in the other, a war is only just getting started.
Yeah, we're really going to talk about war this week. We're going to get really in-depth about how we feel about war and peace, and how they are a very good book. Great book. Let's jump in.
Great. Have you actually read it?
War and Peace?
Yeah.
No.
War and Peace. Yeah, Tolstoy. I think, isn't he the guy who wrote that other one, Crime and Punishment?
I think so. And The Brothers Crime. Of Love, I think, is one of his
two. Oh, no, that's Dostoevsky. Sorry.
Oh, maybe I'm wrong, too. Well, I don't remember.
Well, look, this isn't Russian author podcast.
mostly what I remember about that War and Peace book is that there's a dumb song about it where it's like, War and Peace is a very, very, very long book. Which is just true.
Well, I thought it was initially I thought it was Tolstoy who did write Crime and Punishment, and we were supposed to read Crime and Punishment when I was in school, and I did not even kind of finish it because it was so long and it was very, very dense, and I was struggling to hold on to it.
Where did you fall? Were you on the side of crime or punishment?
You know, I don't think I got far enough into it to even really give credence to the question.
Yeah.
Is how great I was at reading that book.
Yeah.
It's like, it's one of those things, you know, you like read all these books in school. And one, I'm definitely the type of person that like, if I'm reading for pleasure, I'm not a super fast reader, but I love to read. So I really enjoy it. And if I'm reading for like a requirement of some kind, the joy is like sucked out of it entirely.
Yeah.
And it becomes a chore and it's very, very hard for me to focus on it. A little bit less so now, but I do still feel that with like, I'm on the programming committee for my local community theater. So we read plays that we're considering for the upcoming season. And even then it's like, it's hard for me to like bring myself to read them. Even when I'm interested, because I'm just like, ugh, I have to. That sense of obligation turns it into work instead of fun. So I struggled with that in school. And then you get things like my favorite book, which is To Kill a Mockingbird. And that was required reading, and it was delightful. And I enjoyed every second of it, and it was an easy read. And then you get something like possibly my least favorite book, The Scarlet Letter, which was a slog to get through. An absolute snooze fest. Just so fucking boring.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, you get a real mixed bag. And I would say Crime and Punishment, for me, fell onto the Scarlet Letter side of things.
Well, in anime news, Jujutsu Kaisen is back for its new season. So,
oh,
if you are not caught up, you definitely should listen to our
episodes. We should start covering that show a few weeks ago. We should start covering that in the recent past.
Yeah, we have. We have started covering that in the recent
what?
Past.
What? Yeah.
We also have to figure out where we're going to slot in the movie. I'm assuming we're going to do it as they released it, which would be after the first season. So
did they do the thing that Demon Slayer did, where instead of putting the next story arc in a season, they released it as a movie? So you have to watch the movie in order to get the full canon story?
No, so Jujutsu Kaisen Zero actually follows a story that is basically a flashback story that happens, and it makes more sense if you have more context. So it's like a cool prequel thing that's going to prepare you for a character that's going to be introduced inside of later Jujutsu Kaisen. So just, yeah, it's a really interesting way that they did that. And the manga actually does it as well. So it's
okay.
Follows so along with it. The movie's fantastic, so it's like by the way.
Canon, but it's technically able to be considered supplemental, so they just moved it into a movie slot.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. So I mean, it definitely is canon, though. It happened in the universe. The characters you see are affected inside the universe. The things that happened to a specific character did, and you need to know about them. Honestly, you don't need to know about them, but if you know about them, you will also be like more. There will be more questions raised than answered, and it will make the story richer. So,
okay. Interesting. Yeah, well, you know, we usually, traditionally, historically, we reserve movies as crossover episodes, but we did many moons ago, probably the first movie we covered on the show, we covered Cowboy Bebop the movie, which is actually not canonical and is not required viewing, but is so great.
Yeah.
So we'll probably cover that as a part of our regular coverage.
Yeah. Well, that being said, we do have other coverage, which is that we are still watching the new Star Wars Visions series. And this one, it was definitely good. My issue with it is that I'm getting to the point with Visions where I'm just like, I wish the studios had talked to each other. Because I feel like they're... Do you also kind of feel like they're all kind of treading the same road a little bit? Like, this one, the whole, like, accepting yourself and the fact that you have light and dark inside of you is, like, you know, it's been told a couple of times now.
I agree with you that that's true, but for me, I think it is an intentional thematic decision. Like, I think they were, like, the theme of this year's Star Wars Visions is... you know, the light and dark inside of us all and stuff like that. So that's kind of the impression I've been getting. And of course, the result of that is that you do have very similar story beats or very similar story conclusions. But it's like, you know, it's been a while since we covered Star Wars Visions Season 1. But I think Star Wars Visions Season 1 was a little bit more of a proof of concept. And so I felt like they were just like, here is Star Wars, do what you want with it. And that was fun. And the fun of that, especially for people like us, was seeing Star Wars done in anime by legit anime studios.
Yeah.
And then you get to the now times, and it's like, it was successful enough that they brought it back. They brought it back with a similar but different premise where... Season 1 was anime studios. Now it's just global animation. And so that's all interesting. But yeah, I felt like between the two seasons, they were like, okay, if we're going to do this, there should be some unifying principle between these otherwise disparate stories. And also the fact that like they don't have to be connected to each other. They don't have to be connected to the canon. Like, as far as I can tell, each of these stories is an offshoot that is not intended to be, like, considered as part of the canon of the Star Wars universe. And so they're just able to... They're kind of able to do, like, whatever they want.
Yeah.
I guess. And so I think because the first one was a looser concept of let's just do an anthology series using famous anime studios, this time around, I think they introduced that element. So that's a long way of saying I agree with you, but I'm less put off by it because for me, it's more of a season-wide unifying theme to try and tie them all together.
Yeah. Also, in relation to this episode that we watched of Star Wars Visions, this studio is a studio that I've seen a lot from before, because Studio MIR, I think it's pronounced Mer, but it put out one of the most underrated animated shows that I have seen in recent memory, which is that I've brought up to a couple of people that, like, I sort of liked Power Rangers as a kid. Like, really liked Power Rangers up until now.
Up until and though, including now.
Here's the thing, though. I didn't really like Power Rangers as much because I thought it was too much camp. And instead of having camp, you could have fun space explorations, and then your big giant robot was made out of smaller cats. Then you would like Voltron, because the new Voltron is fucking fantastic. It's on Netflix. I've watched all of it. I really like that show.
Apparently, and I've only heard rumors of this, so grain of salt, apparently the fandom is not always the best.
Really?
Which, you know, fandom can often be a breeding ground for hot takes taken too far. But yeah, I've heard pretty negative things about the fandom for that. But the show itself is very good. I've not watched all of it, but I've watched much of it, and it's quite good.
Yeah.
This studio did that. They did Legend of Korra, which I felt like they were very much pulling from their Avatarverse experience with some of the music choices in these sequences. They've done the Kipo and the Age of Wonder Beasts, which I believe is also on Netflix and has gotten really good reviews. And this is a Korean studio. So this story takes place in some sort of undisclosed I almost want to say like religious order or kind of like monk commune situation. It's not a commune when they're monks, but whatever that word is. Where like you see this little girl and she's practicing the kind of like local technique, which is they
should have said troop when you were thinking about what they were a commune, because a troop is
troop.
You call a bunch of monkeys. They're a
not monkeys, monks. Monks and monkeys are very different.
No. When you're a monk, you're just training to become a monkey. And you haven't earned your EY yet.
You're like, you're a monk, or you're a monk with an E, or you're finished.
Yeah.
So there's this girl, she lives in this community where there's
monkeys.
There are these like two giants to shut up. She lives in this community where there's like two giant statues. One is supposed to represent the fuck you. So one statue is supposed to represent the like the light side of the force, and one is supposed to represent the dark side of the force. And there are these stones at the bottom of a chasm between the statues, which reminded me quite a bit of the statues in the, what is it, the Valley of Destiny or whatever, where Naruto and Sasuke fight each other.
Yeah.
It was very, very reminiscent of that from a design standpoint. And so then when it rains and the rain comes down between those two statues, the stones at the bottom resonate with some sort of undefined energy, and they create prophetic kind of watermark visions on the stones. And so this girl's part of this community that's trying to learn how to view and decipher these prophetic visions. And then it does a time skip to a few years later when she's older and she has left because she has this idea in her mind that the statues themselves are somehow kind of nebulously, magically contributing to the strife in the galaxy that is caused by and driven by the rift between Sith and Jedi. And so she goes searching for somebody to help her in a quest to literally destroy the Sith statue as a means of balancing out the universe. She is granted permission to go on this mission, I guess, and she is paired with a Jedi who has his own history with a Sith Lord that seemed to have killed his master a long time ago and left him scarred and indicated that he expected the kid to, you know, become evil because he has feelings. And so this Jedi gets paired with her, and he's having visions, and they go on this quest to the valley, and then the Sith Lord realizes that they're there, and they get into a big fight, and then the girl has to, you know, decide what she's going to do about these statues, and there's a really cool moment near the end that I won't spoil that sets up an interesting resolution. That's the story. So, yeah, what were your thoughts on this, other than not necessarily vibing with the recurring theme here?
I don't know. I don't think the word I would use is not vibing with it. It's more so it just felt like it was overdone. And I mean, like, that's not always a bad thing, you know. Like, honestly, the story of this universe, really, it's sort of like the same well-trod thing sort of over and over and over again. Yeah. That's just kind of how Star Wars works. But it's, at the same time, it's just like, you know, this one didn't blow me away as much. I did think, though, that it might have been because I just wasn't obsessed with the animation style. Just because I've seen this exact animation a bunch of times. And I like the studio and the way that it's done, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that I've been, you know, was dying to watch over and over again, just because I've seen their style and I've seen it done a bunch of different ways. Mostly because I watched like all of Korra and also Voltron. So for me, this was my first one where I was just like, I think I could have skipped it, but it's okay.
Okay. I had a very different reaction. I loved this one quite a bit, and one of the things I loved about it in particular was the animation, which I would say, you know, you're not saying that the animation was bad. You're just saying that the animation from the other ones grabbed you because it felt more novel, and this one felt more familiar, so it didn't grab you. Is that right?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah, which I think makes perfect sense. I did feel like, oh, this is the studio that did Avatar, and then I don't think it is the studio actually that did The Last Airbender, but the fact that they're the ones that did Korra, I was like, yep, that tracks. That felt very familiar to me. But it felt like when you watch an animated show, and then that animated show gets to make a movie, and the budget hits, and it was like, this is familiar animation, but taken up a notch. And so for me, that was really exciting to have them do these like huge, colorful vistas, and to have them, you know, playing with like the sort of moving lines on a character to give movement to every sequence. I found that to be really, really beautiful and really, really satisfying. The action was really good. Very, very nice. Like, you know, we often say on this show that it's hard to describe a fight scene, but a lot of these fight scenes are really good and worth watching. And I would say that this episode falls under that, is the second half of it basically is a really flashy, gorgeously animated fight sequence between the Jedi character and the Sith character. And it is really, really visually impressive. And there's lots of interesting camera angles and some swooping camera work and stuff that really just lends an uncommon dynamism to this that you wouldn't see usually in most animated shows, but that I think because this is a short form special animation project, they were able to sort of indulge in that. And I just thought the whole thing was really fun and exciting. We've said this a ton. We've said it a few times in season two, and we said it a bunch of times in season one. I wish this were a show.
Yeah.
Because this was a really interesting story. These characters felt really interesting, and this felt like a pilot or even a season finale type of situation. And then, you know, they wander off into the sunset, presumably never to be seen again, because these are not supposed to be setting anything up. They're just artistic things. Yep. And so, that's always a little disappointing. But yeah, I thought this was great. I thought it was. I found it pretty visually breathtaking overall, and I just really enjoyed it. I thought I want more action-y stories, and this one was definitely more anime than any of the other ones in this season. So it felt a little bit like hey, this is season one vibes a little bit. And season one was much more action-packed and stuff like that. And so, yeah, I liked that a lot.
Yeah. Well, with that being said, we do have our normal coverage. And let's go ahead and throw 45 seconds on the clock and get a previously on Naruto Shippuden. So do you need to drink some water? Do you need to stretch?
Yeah, I'm going to take a... I literally was stretching when you said the word stretch.
Yeah. He's just got to get ready.
I got some more. I just have to talk about six things. I wrote them down earlier. I just got to get through six things.
All right. And you are go.
Naruto is a story about a kid named Naruto who's training to become a ninja. He lives in a world full of ninja villages. He had two teammates growing up, Sasuke and Sakura. Sasuke has since defected to the baddies out of a sense of revenge, but he's gotten his revenge and now he's still with the baddies and they don't know how to deal with it. Naruto wants to get him back and Sakura's starting to question that whole situation. There's a big villain named Tobi who is also secretly Madara, who is a guy that definitely should be dead but isn't. He has just declared war on all the allied ninja villages who became allied at what's called the Kage Summit, where all the heads of the villages meet, and they decided to form a great ninja alliance, and one of those guys is this guy named Danzo, who's supposedly the head of Naruto's village, but is maybe not the best guy, and we're going to have to deal with that.
You finished early. You finished 3 seconds early.
Yeah, I did.
Proud of you, Blake.
That was horrifying.
All right, so let's jump in. Episode 205, Declaration of War. Toby's going to show up and be a huge bitch. What he's going to do first is he's going to be like, let me just yeet Sasuke and Karin out of the room. And he's just going to...
Because they're injured from last episode.
He's going to put him in a little pocket universe.
Yeah. Must be nice to have your own little secret pocket universe where you can just stow your friends to go heal up.
Yeah, Toby definitely, his other place that he stays is that weird mirror thing that, what's-his-name was trapped inside of in the Superman movies.
Oh, yeah, was that Zod?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's in the Zodverse.
Either that or, like, it's like he has the inside of Mary Poppins' bag everywhere he goes.
It's like, you know, there's Enter the Spider-Verse, and then you enter the Toby-verse. And,
yeah, it's his bag of holding. Although,
that the Toby-verse just sounds like a different version of the Spider-verse, because Tobey Maguire.
Oh, yeah. That, a movie that I would never watch.
What, you don't like cool youth pastors?
Yeah, I mean, it's him dancing down the street while looking mildly goth, and then also there's a horse there for some reason.
Oh, can I just tell you that speaking of camp, which if anybody who is not gay knows camp, it's Sam Raimi. And when Spider-Man 3 came out, the scene where Peter Parker is dancing down the street was lampooned left and right by people who somehow, astonishingly, thought that he was supposed to be cool in that scene. And it's like crazy to me that people missed the mark so badly, because everybody on the street is looking at him like he has gone completely insane and he's oblivious to it. And the joke is at his expense. And then, like, you know, it's not the best movie, although it's better than you remember, I will say. But, it was hilarious, and it was, like, at his expense, and I thought it was so funny, and then, like, it became this meme to prove how bad the movie was, that how dare he, like, walk around with such confidence, and I was like, did you guys completely misunderstand this? How did you mess up so badly? So yeah. That's just my soapbox, and I just had to get on it, because that always annoys me, and I still see it to this day.
So then he's going to tell you some lore shit. Toby's going to be like, okay, yeah. So if you don't know, what I'm really trying to do is I'm trying to bring everybody together. And the way that I'm going to do that is I'm going to tell you a quick story about how everybody had to be taken care of and treated nicely, because there used to be a guy named the Sage of the Sixpath, and he had a big giant monster that lived inside of him, like you have smaller monsters that live inside of people from your villages. And we locked him up and sent him up to the moon, and so you don't have to deal with him anymore. And he broke it into a whole bunch of different pieces, and those are the lesser monsters. And so my plan is I'm going to be like, you know what? Let's get Big Monster back.
Yeah, that's basically right. And what's interesting here, too, is that Kishimoto is setting up the end game. So what we're doing right now is going into the Naruto Shippuden finale. Now, don't misunderstand me. We have a long way to go before Naruto Shippuden is over. But this is, if I can editorialize a little bit about what I think is happening here, is that he has finally figured out what the villains are doing. And he is, he has a sense of where he wants the story to go and how he wants to get to an ending. And he's ready to tell the audience it. And I think that that is the meta reason why Toby says all this shit to them. Because up until this point, none of the stuff that they're doing doesn't fit, but this is a lot of new information. And it's a little bit of a secret plan behind the plan situation, which I enjoy, where it was like, oh, the Akatsuki were doing A, but it was actually secretly in the service of B. And that's cool. I like plot elements like that. But I also feel like, from a writing standpoint, this definitely feels like, for the last couple of months, I've been trying to figure out what the end game of this whole situation is going to be. I figured out it was going to be something to do with the big giant monsters. And now I finally decided on what that is. And so I can maneuver the story into a position where the villain character can officially announce the plan and do a James Bond. And that really feels like what's happening here.
Also, Toby's also going to reveal that, like, his plan to unite the world is to turn everybody into basically subjugated slaves of his. And he says it in a way where it's just like, that's how you get peace. And it's just like,
right?
No, like, I understand that you think that you're doing something, you know, like, we've talked about this a lot of times. A good villain believes that everybody else is wrong and they are right because they are doing something that is right. I don't 100% believe that Toby thinks that he's doing the right thing here. It sounds more like he's a villain that's got a good plan for world domination. So that's what he's decided to do. And he roped in these suckers in.
Right. It's definitely kind of God complex vibes, which is nice. I would say, I think the two types of good villains, he said, knowing that there are more than two types out there. But, you know, you get the villain who thinks that what they're doing is right, and you get the villain who knows that what they're doing is wrong, but believes that it must be done for some sort of greater good, and that nobody else has the courage or conviction or whatever to do it. And I think he's the first one. I really think that he believes that the sort of strife and the lack of peace and the lack of consistency or whatever that has been caused by their warring society is a great, you know, bane to their world, and that this is a solution for it. But I don't think that he's insincere in that, although, I don't know, maybe later elements of the story might contradict that. So we'll see. But as it stands right now, I think that he can be taken as just delusionally earnest, because it is that kind of, like, nobody can solve this problem but me, which is buffoonery, right? Like, when people say that in real life, you're like, you're a fucking idiot. Like, there's never a situation that can only be solved by one person. There may be a few situations that where only one person has the power. I'm thinking of, like, if you're the one leader of a global country, you might be the one who has the power to solve the thing, but if somebody else were in that position, they might also be able to solve it. Like, there's really no situation in which only one person in the entire fucking world could solve a thing. And unless, you know, to say otherwise is delusional, you know? And so this is kind of that situation where he's convinced himself that he's such hot shit that he's the only one around that can handle this problem, when really he's just kind of creating a problem out of his own, you know, self-satisfaction.
Yeah. And so next he's gonna be like, all right, so as long as you know as well what I'm trying to do is great, you should hand over Killer Bee and Naruto. And everybody's just like, what? Killer Bee is dead. And he's like, no, Killer Bee faked his own death. He's still alive. Hand him over to me. And they're like, no. And Toby's like, fucking fine then. I declare war on all of you. And this is going to be how it's going to go. And then he like storms out of the room, but really he just disappears. So...
yeah, I do not for a second believe that he thought they would give him up. Yeah. I'm pretty sure he knew exactly what they were going to say, and he was just going to extend this offer in case they surprised him. But he did not ever believe that they were going to give up Killer Bee or Naruto. It is also funny that he knows that Killer Bee is alive, but not where he is. And that they didn't. And then after he tells them, yes, in fact, our attempt to capture him failed. He is still alive. He is at large. Give him to me. And they're like, we just told you that we didn't know he was alive. What the hell? It's pretty okay. Solid. Pretty solid work.
Yeah. So after this, Mifune is like, Danzo, you fucked up. And Danzo is just like, okay. But hold on real quick, and then just exits.
He's big screw you guys, I'm going home energy.
Yeah, and then everybody else is just like, okay, we gotta find B and Naruto and then hide them away so that Mr. Eye in the Sky put his eye on the moon. It cannot destroy the planet. Anyways, let's go into
episode 206. Oh yeah, because he's gonna reflect his eyes off the moon. Because this whole story is just about eyes.
And then we're gonna go into episode 206, which is the most... Sakura named episode ever, which is just called Sakura's Feelings.
Yeah. What's Sakura's personality? Sakura's feelings.
Yeah. Okay, so Sakura's like, I need to talk to you, Naruto. And he's like, okay. And then she's like, I'm in love with you. And he's like, what?
Yeah. This is such bullshit, and I absolutely forgot this happened, and I was genuinely upset when it did.
Yeah,
she is lying to him to manipulate his feelings, because she knows that he's in love with her.
Yeah.
And so her plan here is that Naruto made a promise to her at her tearful begging request many years ago. Sasuke's left the village. Please do everything in your power to bring him back. And Naruto, I think, probably would have made that pledge to himself, by himself, without any help from Sakura, just to be fair. But he did technically make it to her. And now she's like, doesn't want him to do it anymore, because Sasuke is causing too many problems, and she's not happy about it. She definitely still wishes that they could get Sasuke back, but she doesn't believe that they can. And so she knows that Naruto is, well, in the positive way, he is a man of his word. In the negative way, he's boneheaded. and he will never give up this quest, ever, ever, ever. And so the only way she can think to do it is to lie and try and gaslight him into believing that she actually has real feelings for him, when it is just a ruse to get him to be too in love with her to care about the Sasuke thing anymore. And he calls her out on it right away, which I very much appreciate.
Yeah, okay. So this leads to Kiba, Lee, Sai, and they run off to go find Sasuke. And meanwhile, they are looking for B in different places. However, B has been... he's been... I don't know how this... This was confusing to me. So, like, the only reason they were able to find B was just because this sword was just like, I smell his chakra? Is that my understanding of how they found him?
Yeah, basically. So Killer Bee has massive chakra because he's a Jinjiriki. And they're kind of making a seafood joke here, actually. So his Killer Bee's tailed beast is a bull with octopus tentacles. And that's what makes the eight tails, is eight octopus tentacles. And Samehada is a shark skin sword. Samehada also, it turns out, and I'm not sure we've known this in the past, but we learn it here if we haven't learned it before. Samehada is at least partly sentient. And so it seeks out Killer Bee's chakra because it's a shark and Killer Bee is an octopus. So at the end of the day, it is kind of just a seafood joke. But it is not particularly presented jokingly, but that's why this is happening. Yeah. That is also why, for example, Naruto, who also has a tailed beast sealed inside of him, and consequently also has access to massive, massive, massive chakra reserves, is not sought out by Samehada, because Samehada, as a shark, does not want to eat the fox. It wants to eat the octopus. So he shows up. Samehada shows up with Kisame in tow, because Kisame is the wielder of Samehada the Blade, and they're going to fight. And I forgot this happened entirely too. I remember the Kage Summit being really interesting. I remember Sasuke, you know, blowing up their spot. And I guess just the fallout of that, I thought there's a Danzo thing that we're going to get to next time that I definitely thought was the next thing that happened, and that was what we were going to watch this week. And instead it's this.
Yeah. So this leads into the probably the most busted ability that Samehada has, which is that it can just eat chakra. It just can just kind of drain into it, which is like kind of a dumb ability that happens so often inside of different things where it feels like the author can't 100% figure out how to deal with a character that they made too powerful. So they're just like, this person can either cancel things, or they have the ability to absorb other things so that they can become stronger than the other person and use it back on them.
Yeah.
And that feels very much like this situation. So Samehada is going to absorb almost all of B's energy, become massive, and it is later used by Kisame in order to like take down B to the point where like he is able to be taken if he couldn't get him.
Yeah, but there is a hitch in the plan, which I think technically happens in the next episode.
Yeah, episode 207, the tailed beast versus the tailless tailed beast.
So the tailless tailed beast, this is a weird thing. So before the Kage Summit breaks up, I'm rewinding just a little bit, but I noticed how odd this was and how like tacked on it felt. The Kage Summit is just ending after Madara has declared war and then vanished himself in a portal. And they're like, well, shit. It's nice that we're all allied together now, but also war has been declared on us by a functionally ancient, seemingly immortal, seemingly invincible character. And so, you know, it's kind of a wash as far as positive news. And we're all going to go home to our respective villages, because we're just the leaders on a diplomatic mission right now. We're going to tell them all that we formed this alliance. And there's also, you almost never see this, but technically in Naruto's world, the ninja villages are part of a larger country that is not entirely made up of ninja. And that country is ruled by a feudal lord. So technically, each of these villages comes from a different country with a different feudal lord over it. And so they're like, we've got to go home and tell the boss what decision we've made here, and also that war has been declared on us. And then one of the bodyguards, who he works for the village Hidden in the Mists leader, and he is carrying one of the legendary swords, which Samehada is a legendary sword. And then Zabuza from the very first arc of Naruto was another legendary swordsman. And he's like, okay, by the way, before we leave, and not that anybody asked or was talking about this at all, just off the top of my head, what I'm thinking about right now is that there's a guy named Kisame who has one of these swords also. And just a fun fact about him, just I was looking at his Wikipedia article earlier, and I wanted to let you guys know that he is considered the tailless tailed beast because his power level is so great that he can rival people who are Jinchuriki, which is to say have giant demon-tailed beasts locked inside of their bodies. He has almost that much power just by being who he is. And, you know, just a fun fact for everybody here at the meeting. And yeah, it's just like, it feels like that because he just says it. What is that phrase? Apropos of nothing. He just says it out loud with no prompting and with no apparent reason. And the secret real reason is that the author realized that was the next thing he was going to do. And he needed to set up the tension for that in some way. So he wanted to bring it up there, but it's just so fucking out of left field in the actual story flow. And it was really funny and weird, but that is why, because apparently, not that it's ever happened before now in the story that we've seen, but apparently technically Kisame is considered the tailless tailed beast. And that is some sort of name that he goes by or is known by. And yeah, he's going to show up. He's going to fight Killer Bee. He's going to beat Killer Bee pretty handily. I wouldn't say it's a curb stomp battle where Killer Bee's never getting in any good hits. But just like Kisame is too strong and resilient. So whatever hits he does get in are just not, they just don't, they don't leave any lasting impression. And then Samehara is siphoning off B's energy, so he's getting weaker while Kisame is getting stronger. And eventually Kisame's got him where he wants him. He's down. I believe he says he's going to chop off some of Killer B's limbs so that Samehara can eat his energy and Kisame can like fully subdue him, but he won't kill Killer B because then they still have to do the ritual to get the beast out of him. And then there's a weird turn.
Yeah, well, I is going to show up, and he's going to decide that he is going to be the fighting. I can't think of the word for it. It's like a Superman complex thing. I cannot remember. It's like a it's one of those words, kind of like a Deus Ex Machina, except for it's a hero. This is going to bother me. Anyways,
I see. Yeah, I see what you're saying. It does feel a little bit like a Deus Ex Machina. I would say the bigger Deus Ex Machina is yet another thing that hasn't been introduced, which is that Samehara defects to Killer Bee. And so Kisame is about to chop his limbs off, and then the sword won't listen to him because it likes the octopus energy too much. And now the sword wants to belong to Killer Bee instead. So Kisame has been disarmed. And then Kisame also created a giant water prison to trap Killer Bee in a zone to fight him so that he could not flee. And that prison was huge. And so I was able to see it from miles away. I being the Raikage, the leader of the village from where Killer Bee is from, and also Killer Bee's brother, who was pretty upset that Killer Bee was kidnapped and is arguably even more upset now to have learned that he was not kidnapped and instead allowed himself to be believed to be kidnapped so he could fuck off and go practice his rap. And so he's on the warpath to give Killer Bee a big fucking talking to. And he rolls up right about as we find out that Samehara is going to defect from Kisame. So Kisame has now been disarmed, and now the battle has not only turned against him in that respect, but also has become a two-on-one situation.
Yeah, and they're going to decapitate him, basically.
Yep.
They use this like team-up attack, which is super cool, and then they're just going to take Kisame out.
These big, strong boys with their hard-hitting physical attacks are some of the coolest fighters in Naruto, just because I think there's such a visceral sense to their attacks. It's really fun. I also think, in general, this Kisame fight goes some weird places. And sort of, I mean, I know Killer Bee's going to end up with Samehara, because of this fight, but outside of that, this fight feels a little superfluous.
Yeah.
Like, it's not unimportant. Like, right, I believe Kisame is dead for real here, and...
I don't think
so. You know, yeah, I can remember, because I thought there was another fight with him later, so he might still be alive. There are also some shenanigans later in Naruto where whether or not he's alive won't necessarily stop him from having another fight later. But I don't remember if he dies from this, but if he does, it's important because he's been a major character throughout all of Shippuden, and technically also a little bit of the end of pre-Shippuden Naruto. And then he loses his weapon, which has been a defining characteristic of him, and it is adopted by one of our heroes who we will see a lot more of going forward. And so it's like, it's not that this fight is unimportant, but there is something about it that feels sort of like not fillery, but almost where it's like, if you skipped this and just knew that it happened, you'd be fine.
Yeah.
That said, it is interesting. It's not a bad fight. It just has a weird vibe.
Okay, and that takes us into episode 208, As One's Friend, which is my least favorite of all the episodes, because, oh my god, they talk so much in this episode.
Well, you know, that's the power.
Oh my god, it's just all is this, talking.
Is this the one where the trick happens? Oh, there's a second thing that's happening during the Kisame and Killer Bee fight, which is that Danzo is a son of a bitch and wants to steal everybody's eyes all the time.
Oh yeah. And I thought that happened in 208, but it's all about
it might have happened earlier.
He wants to steal the Byakugan.
Yeah, which on the one hand, Byakugan is a Kekkei Genkai, and they definitely have sort of like a proprietary information type of system for this kind of stuff. So in a certain sense, I kind of get it, even though like, okay, we just declared an alliance and now you're going to like backstab one of your allies and try and take his body parts. Not cool, man, but I sort of get it because the Byakugan is like the Leaf Village's thing and nobody else is supposed to have it. And so, you know, whatever, right? You got mean feelings about it, but also Danzo is not trustworthy, so we're able to feel less okay with this. So one of the Mizukage's bodyguards gets trapped by a body switch jutsu that's triggered by a puppet trap, where the puppet traps your mind because you like looked at it wrong or something like that. And then the jutsu caster, which is one of Danzo's bodyguards, gets to take over your body, similar to but better than What's-Her-Face from the Leaf Village. And then he's trying to kill himself while in the body of this dude, because then that dude will be dead and they will be able to come back and harvest the eye from the guy. But there's a protective spell, kind of like Doctor Strange's protective spell over the Time Stone, that stops him from pulling the eye out. I guess he was going to pull the eye out and the protective spell showed up, and then he was going to kill himself in the dude's body so that they could just harvest the eye from the corpse. And then the Mizukage shows up and is like, "You're acting weird. What is happening?" And he tries to pretend to be the guy, but this is one of the Mizukage's bodyguards, so she sees through it like instantaneously and is like, "Bro would never speak like this. You're not bro. So I'm gonna, you know, capture you." It's just it's not uninteresting, but it's just sort of political maneuvering in the background that's just adding to the world, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know.
Technically.
It's interesting. Anyways, episode that we're in now is going to be all about Gaara, talking about Gaara things.
Yeah, he's got a lot of feelings ever since he learned how to feel things that weren't murder lust, and he's feeling them.
Yeah, that's a great way to say shit.
Yeah, definitely. Sai's going to come talk to Naruto, by which I mean Sai is going to make an ink clone of himself to go talk to Naruto, because Sai is busy being with Sakura and all that group that Spencer listed off earlier that are going out to try and find and kill Sasuke. And he's going to show up and be like, everybody's going after Sasuke because you realized that she was lying to you. She's taking matters into her own hands, and we're going to try and find him and kill him. And specifically, she's going to try and kill him personally. It's a whole thing. So just, you know, letting you know that that's happening with the girl you love. So that's helpful. And then, yeah, then Gaara's going to roll through and I guess kind of pile on a little bit here to Naruto. Naruto's eating a lot of shit in this arc.
Yeah. Truly the shit eater.
Yeah, so Gaara shows up and he tells... This is interesting. He tells Kakashi to go home and tell the Leaf Village what has transpired at the Kage Summit. And the reason is because he rightly assumes that Danzo is a bitch and is going to do his own thing and is maybe not going to hold to the Alliance and is maybe not going to tell them. And so he's just working around it, I guess. I don't know if this is moving in the shadows or if all the Kage were like, Danzo sucks, let's work around that. Because none of them like him and none of them trust him. And he was publicly rebuked. But I don't remember them saying, like, we need to get somebody else to relay this message after he left. So anyway, that's what they're doing. And Gaara's going to have him do that message. And then he has this conversation with Naruto about the meaning of friendship, basically. So, yeah. You know, when your friend defects to an enemy faction and then declares war on your home and on everything and everyone you love, and you're like, but he's my friend, though.
Yeah.
And Gaara is like, maybe, just maybe, sometimes there are things that are bigger than your childhood friendship. And I would just really appreciate it if you would reflect on that and think about whether maybe some of what I'm saying to you might ring true to your personal situation. And Naruto is like, nah.
Yeah.
He's stubborn. I don't know. We've talked before about, like, one of the things that usually defines a shonen anime protagonist is stubborn idealism. And I think it is one of the things that can help make a shonen protagonist endearing and can kind of help sell you on them as a heroic figure of, like, they, you know, no matter what challenges they face, they'll never give up that ideals. And that is a heroic ideal in and of itself. But it is very hard not to side with Gaara on this. Like, do you agree with me? Like, Sasuke sucks.
Yeah. It's really just like, there was this story about these two people and they need to be the two people that are going to be the same kind of two people that were brothers that were in the past in order to make the show work. And in order to do that, I need a main character who is unflinchingly, unwaveringly allied to this person no matter what the fuck happens because friendship. And so he's going to just not listen to fucking... You know what? I think Naruto has like a little bit of like battered wife syndrome. Like he just,
oh my god, a little bit.
He loves Sasuke even though Sasuke is horrible to him, and it's just,
well,
like,
it was his first kiss, so
yeah, so he just loves him unconditionally, and he's just like, just, I think I can change him, you guys.
I can change him. He's just, give me time. Yeah, it's not good. And he's, yep. It's just so we're clear, the situation is my childhood friend who did fucking hate me for a long time, but then sort of begrudgingly came to respect me
and eventually thought of me as a friend, even though he didn't always treat me like it. Because Sasuke was never particularly nice to Naruto. He did develop a respect for him eventually, very shortly before his defection. But he was always kind of a shit to Naruto. And then Naruto's like, he was my brother. And now he's a terrorist. And he's defected to the terrorists. But he did it to deal with his own personal problems. And he did a little bit of terror. But then he solved his personal problems. And now he should come home. But he didn't. He decided after that that he was going to keep doing terrorism. And now I don't think he should be considered a terrorist. And I'm like, I get that it's hard to recontextualize what you know about somebody that you've seen in a more sympathetic light when they do something bad that you would not have previously believed them capable of doing. But it's happening, bud. And your stance just doesn't hold a lot of water here. Like, you're really just grasping at straws at this point.
Okay.
So we'll see.
Let's talk about how this episode ends, by the way. So, Tobi is going to intercept Danzo at the very end of this episode. And Danzo is going to be like, fuck, 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 fuck. And he's going to start, like, unsealing things from his arm. And meanwhile, Tobi is just murdering his people that are trying to make sure that he doesn't get murdered. But they are no match for Tobi. And so Danzo is just like, he understands he has to be at 100% full power in order to fight whatever the fuck is about to come at him from Tobi. But instead of fighting him himself, Toby's just going to be like, surprise, I'm going to summon from this Pokeball Sasuke and Karin.
It is like that. He is a Pokemon at this point.
Yep. Yeah. He's been summoned from a distant realm that is inside of a small ball.
It's Pokemon.
To fight against his opponent.
Yeah, Sasuke is a Pokemon. Print it, take it to the bank. We figured it out. We cracked Naruto today. So yeah, it's really interesting. All around. And I guess to sort of refute what I was just saying, technically it has, since Sasuke got his revenge, he has found out that Danzo has been a motherfucker for years and was sort of behind the whole thing where Sasuke's entire family was killed. And so technically you could consider that this is perhaps a continuation of his revenge quest that made him defect to the baddies, and that therefore he's not actually finished, and that therefore he has not found his revenge and maybe semi-justified and still being part of the villain team. But I don't know. I still argue that reasoning is growing pretty thin on that. So anyway, he's gonna try and get some revenge next time that I definitely thought was happening this time.
Yep, and listen to our after the credits and you'll find out what's coming on next week.
Blake and Spencer Get Jumped is made by Forever Summer Productions and presented as part of the Geekly Grind Podcast Network.
Sound editing is done by Rashad English. He's our level 15 sound wizard. Fireball! 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 Ad-free versions of our podcast are available on Patreon, along with extra Patreon-only goodies, like additional conversations and articles written by the hosts.
Follow us on Twitter at @BandSGetJumped.
Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/BlakeAndSpencerGetJumped.
Or talk to us on Reddit at reddit.com/r/getjumped.
We also have a Discord server, and you can find links to that on our social media platforms.
If you like the show, please like, subscribe, and leave a review. Reviews help other listeners find our show.
New episodes come out every week.
Thanks for listening. Next week on Blake and Spencer Get Jumped, we're recording an episode for patrons for Bleach episodes 69 through 73, and non-patrons will get the second episode of Bleach coverage.
So, if you want to live in the past, if you're some of those people that were just like, you know what was better, like 2 years ago, you can listen to that episode. Ooh. And if you're one of those Ooh. People that's just like, maybe I should get up to date, you should just join the Patreon already.
Yeah, 2 years ago. I don't think I want to go back there, Spencer.